Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, from courthouse shakeups to local leadership battles, Pennsylvania's May 20th primary is over. We'll speak with the River Reporter's Leah Mayo about key races in Wayne and Pike counties, high-stake judicial contests, and what the results mean heading into November. Science stories with Joe Johnson. Our science guy has some stories that really caught his eye, including some really cute hairy mice and turning lead into gold. And if you're looking for more than just campfires and canoeing this summer, Frost Valley YMCA has specialty overnight camps where kids can hike, ride horses, and grow their own food. We'll learn more about how these programs are changing lives, one camper at a time, plus more. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel says it has allowed some aid into Gaza. This comes after nearly 3 months of a total blockade of the Palestinian enclave. The UN says a handful of trucks are there, but no aid has reached Palestinians. NPR's Hadil Alshelchi reports Palestinian babies have been badly affected.
In the Patient Friends Hospital's malnutrition department in Gaza City, Ilham Abdelhafid waits for her daughter to be seen by a doctor. The 28-year-old woman says her 1-year-old daughter is weak and won't stop crying from hunger. Abdelhafid says she has no milk to feed her baby and just gives her daughter water. She's really tortured, Abdelhafid says. She's suffering because of a lack of nutrition. On Monday, Israel said it allowed some baby food into Gaza, of which Abdelhafid says she hasn't seen any. The UN says it's not enough, and that the denial of essential supplies to civilians risks breaching international law. Hadil Alshalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The House Rules Committee is still in session, trying to finish work on the multi-trillion dollar budget bill backed by President Trump. The committee started work just after midnight. All Democrats oppose the budget bill, and Republicans' majority in the House is so small they can only lose 3 votes. They may not have them yet. Fiscal conservatives say the proposal balloons the U.S. debt. Other Republicans, such as New York Congressman Mike Lawler, are demanding the restoration of a federal tax deduction for state and local taxes. He says he won't vote for the budget bill without that fix.
The president wants us to come to agreement. We spent the better part of yesterday afternoon and into the evening meeting with the speaker coming to terms on an agreement. But we're still working through some of the finer points.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. House Speaker Mike Johnson told CNN this morning he thinks there's a deal on the tax deduction. He says he thinks the full House will vote on the budget bill later today. Stocks opened lower this morning after some mixed results from big retailers. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 280 points in early trading.
Discount retailer Target reported disappointing sales and earnings for the most recent quarter and lowered its forecast for the full year. The chain's become a target for both sides in the culture wars, prompting boycotts. Like other retailers, Target's also wrestling with the rising cost of tariffs. The home improvement chain Lowe's had slightly better news for investors, with profits that outpaced low expectations. Lowe's sales dropped during the quarter, but not as much as had been feared. The yield on government bonds continues to climb as House Republicans inch closer to passing a big tax cut and spending bill. Congressional forecasters say that measure's tax cuts will add $3.8 trillion to the federal debt over the next decade. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. President Trump welcomes South African President Cyril Ramaphosa to the White House today. The visit comes as relations between the two countries have frayed. Trump has admitted a group of white South Africans to the U.S. as refugees, claiming white genocide. South Africa rejects the claim, saying it is demonstrably false. South Africa says that Trump is also bringing billionaire Elon Musk to the White House meeting. Musk, who was born in South Africa, has also made false claims of genocide against white people in South Africa. The Trump administration is moving toward allowing deep-sea mining in federally controlled waters. It's an effort to boost the production of critical minerals. Daniel Ackerman reports the Interior Department says it's considering selling mineral rights in waters offshore American Samoa.
Interior Secretary Doug Burgum said the move would support economic growth and national security. Mining companies say the seabed near the U.S. territory contains rocks rich in nickel and cobalt, which could be used in electric car batteries. Commercial-scale deep-sea mining has never been done, but the idea is under consideration by at least half a dozen countries. Hundreds of marine scientists have signed a letter opposing the practice, citing potential harm to fisheries and ocean ecosystems. The Interior Department is seeking public comment on the matter before the potential sale of mineral rights. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Ackerman.
The championship series for the Professional Women's Hockey League is now underway. The Ottawa Charge defeated the Minnesota Frost last night 2-1 in overtime. This was the first game of the best of five series. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Voters across Pennsylvania headed to the polls yesterday to cast ballots in a slate of judicial and local primary races. While primary elections often fly under the radar, this year's contests for Commonwealth and Superior Courts, both statewide Republican primaries, drew increased scrutiny amid ongoing debates over election law, education, and the role of the judiciary in shaping public life. In Northeast Pennsylvania, attention also turned to several key local races, including magisterial district judge contests in both Wayne and Pike counties, a mayoral race in Honesdale, and a competitive township supervisor primary in Lackawaxen. These down-ballot contests, though quieter than some statewide matchups, may prove pivotal in determining the direction of local governance and judicial priorities. Here now with the results and to break down what happened at the polls and what it might mean in the November general election is Liam Mayo of The River Reporter. Liam, good morning.
Hi, Tim. Good morning to you as well.
Let's start with the big picture of these Republican primaries for the Commonwealth Court and the Superior Court. They attracted a little bit more attention than usual. Why was that?
Yeah. So the Commonwealth and Superior Courts both have a lot of importance in Pennsylvania. The Commonwealth Court is they both are sort of appellate courts that hear appeals just below the Supreme Court level in Pennsylvania. And the Commonwealth Court specifically is the one that hears cases against state and local government agencies. So if you're talking about cases about election law, talking about cases about school systems, that's kind of where those cases will often end up. For the Republican primary in this race, it had Matthew Wolford, an environmental law specialist, running against Joshua Prince, who runs a law firm specialized in gun legislation. Wolford was the candidate kind of endorsed by the GOP, and he was the candidate who won that particular primary. He will be running against a Court of Common Pleas Judge Sadala Tsai in the general election. She's the Democratic candidate. She ran unopposed in this primary. And for the Superior Court, the Republican primary had Maria Batista, who has served as Assistant General Counsel for Pennsylvania Departments of State and Health, running against Anne Marie Wheatcraft, who is a Chester County Common Pleas judge. Batista won the primary nod. She was the candidate sort of who was not endorsed by the GOP. That was her opponent, Anne Marie Wheatcraft. And Batista will face Brandon Newman, who is another Court of Common Pleas judge in the general election.
And so in the these courts, there's a potential for a partisan shift. What could be at stake for Pennsylvania's in the general election this fall, especially when it comes to some hot button issues like election law or education policy or reproductive rights?
Yeah, it's pretty much exactly as you said. I don't have the sort of partisan makeup of those courts in front of me at this time, so I can't speak to that, unfortunately. But the partisan makeup of those courts is sort of increasingly important as more of public life is litigated through them, as the federal administration takes actions that are sort of challenged through the court system. And in Pennsylvania, there are some sort of major There have been major discussions about educational policy. There was an educational court case that decided several years ago that the state's education system was basically wildly and illegally underfunded, which has led to the major shifts and major ongoing shifts at the state government level to increase that level of funding. There have also been sort of numerous legal questions raised to these courts about election law that have gone back and forth. So the makeup of these boards and the people you put on these boards are kind of more important than ever. It's easy to not think about them, and it's easy not to not sort of really know that they exist, but the decisions they make could have a significant impact on people's lives. So it's good to pay attention to who gets on them.
Yeah, and also with some additional context from our partners at Spotlight PA, it's important to remember that these statewide appellate courts, all three of them, Supreme, Superior, and Commonwealth, those folks are elected to serve 10-year terms. So that election in November, you're going to vote for somebody to impact your life for 10 years. The number of terms they could serve is unlimited, though they must retire at 75. Also, in addition to deciding the races for one vacant seat each on the Commonwealth and Superior Courts this November, voters will consider whether to give five appellate judges additional 10-year terms. That includes three state Supreme Court justices, all of whom were elected as Democrats. These yes or no retention elections are, again, a high-profile target for Republicans hoping to upset a decade of Democratic control on the court in Pennsylvania. So plenty to look at the state-level court level in Pennsylvania coming up in November. Let's zero in locally on some Wayne County races. Jessica Ellis was against Wayne Thomas. That was the race to watch for magisterial district judge. What happened there?
Yeah, so we're kind of jumping to the entirely opposite end of the judicial spectrum here. The Commonwealth and Superior Courts are some of the last courts many cases will see, whereas the magisterial district judge is in oftentimes the first introduction to the legal system a case will get. It's the first place a defendant will often see, and in this particular race, there was a resignation leaving a vacancy, and the primary had Wayne Thomas, a former state trooper, running against Jessica Ellis, an attorney for that seat. And this is one where the primary seems to have sort of resolved the race before it gets to the general. Ellis and Thomas both ran on both parties as the judgeship is a bit of a nonpartisan position, and Ellis has taken both the Republican and the Democratic nods, according to the unofficial results. It was about 1,000 votes for Ellis in the Republican primary versus 500 for her opponent, and then in the Democratic primary, it was 500 votes for her versus around 200 for her opponent. So this is one race that sort of, you know, probably is resolved at this primary level.
Mm-hmm. The other race to watch in Wayne County was the Honesdale mayoral race. There was only one official candidate there. And what happened there?
Yeah, that's one where the race is very much not over and will absolutely be resolved in the general election. The official candidate on the ballot was Jim Hamill, who took around 200 votes in the primary. He is a current borough councillor who has expressed his potential intention of running for mayor against the incumbent mayor, Derek Williams. Williams sort of launched a bit of a write-in campaign before before this primary race, but has expressed his intention to run as an independent candidate, which doesn't go through the primary system. So he will be on the ballot this November as an independent candidate, as he was the last time around 4 years ago when he first won election. There also will likely be a third Republican challenger in that race as well. There were 131 write-in votes for the Republican candidacy for Honesdale Borough Mayor. Yeah, that's a ballot line that didn't have anyone officially on it, but Wayne County Community. Oh,
I was going to say, who was that?
So we don't know yet is the thing. Wayne County community figure, Mike Falco, launched his own writing campaign a couple days before the election. So we can guess that it's him. But I checked with the Wayne County Bureau of Elections this morning to see if they could say who exactly it was. And they said they, by law, can't even start counting the write-in ballots until Friday. So that the confirmation of that won't be available until sometime next week.
And was Hamill running as a Democrat then?
Yes, sorry. Hamill won the Democratic nomination.
So it's a potential three-way race in November. And folks know the current incumbent mayor, Derek, is the walking mayor. He famously got in to the office based on his walking for mayor campaign. Do you sense that voters were engaged overall? Was turnout on par with past primaries?
I heard from Amy Christopher, the director of the Wayne County Bureau of Elections, that turnout was a little down, but on par with turnout for municipal primaries, which generally do not attract a ton of attention.
We're talking to Liam Mayo from the River Reporter about yesterday's primary results in Pennsylvania, including key races in Northeast Pennsylvania. Those include another a battle for a judicial race in Pike County, Christina Ballas versus Paul Mendito. What happened in that race?
Yeah, that is a race that also appears to have been resolved at this current level. Paul Mendito is the longtime incumbent judge in the position. Christina Ballas is launching a challenging campaign. According to the unofficial results, she took both the Republican and the Democratic nominations there. The Republican nomination with around 500 votes to Mendito's around 400, and the Democratic nomination with around 400 votes to Mendito's around 300 as well.
And then Lackawaxen Township Supervisors race saw incumbent Mike Mancino challenging Ray Fennell. What happened there? Also, Fennell was considered or called himself a single issue candidate. What was that single issue?
Yeah. Ray Fennell got into the race or got into politics fairly recently. There was a issue in Lackawaxen Township with a piece of land on the Lackawaxen River called the Freshman's Property that was formerly used as a river launch historically and was still sort of being used as a river launch under private ownership. However, the township had an opportunity to purchase it and turn it into public land and chose to do so, and that project is currently in progress. Fennell was sort of dissatisfied with the way that process was handled and launched this bid for a township supervisor against longtime incumbent Mike Mancino, and Mancino has taken the primary election with around 300 votes to around 100 for Fennell.
And also, let's just run down the other results there. A note about a possible confusion in candidate listings for the Wallenpaupack School District Board candidates. Was that something you can clarify?
Yeah, just the so the Delaware Valley School District elections are, I think, the races to focus on, and that is one where there are four seats available and there are six candidates in each race. And at least according to the results so far, of the six candidates in the primary election, Joseph Kermele, Pam Lupfi, Jessica Decker, Felicia Sheehan, Mandy Coville, and Dorit Smith, five of those candidates will be going on to the general election. Most candidates won or were in that top four for both lists, both the Democratic and the Republican. Dorit Smith lost out the Democratic nomination, but will be nominated as a Republican. the reverse for Joseph Kermele, who got the Democratic nomination but lost out the Republican one. And the one candidate who will not be moving on is Mandy Koville, who took fifth in the four-person race for both the Democratic and the Republican primaries there.
Any trends or surprises you didn't expect to see or pop up for you in these races?
I mean, I think I was surprised to see both the judicial races kind of be as determined as they were this early on. I sort of expected that one candidate would earn one party's nomination while the other candidate would earn the other party's nomination, and then that would go forward to the general election. But it does make some amount of sense, as these judicial positions aren't really political positions. They are, you know, supposed to be these nonpartisan, impartial judicial figures. So even though they are running for a quote-unquote Democratic nomination or a quote-unquote Republican nomination, they're not serving as a Democrat or a Republican. They're serving as a judge. So when voters go to the polls, in theory, the best person should win, which should just, I believe, generally be the case. But it appears to have been more true for these races where than perhaps some others.
Yeah, we always hope that to be true. Liam Mayo from the River Reporter with a wrap-up of some of the results in Pennsylvania's primary yesterday. We'll be staying in touch as we head toward the general in November. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
More at theriverreporter.com. Also yesterday in New York, residents went to the polls across the state to vote on school district budgets and school board candidates. And we'll have an in-depth report on all of that later tonight on the local edition. But in a couple of key school budget questions locally, in the newly formed Rockland Central School District encompassing Livingston Manor and Roscoe, voters approved the more than $32 million spending plan by a vote of 339 to 206. In Liberty, voters approved the budget of $68.5 million by a vote of 658 to 131. They also approved the capital project by a 616 to 167 margin. So overwhelming support there in Liberty. And voters in the Monticello School District approved their budget of $103 million by a vote of 371 to 186. These results are unofficial. For more district budget results and school board results, again, tune in tonight to the local edition or consult the individual websites of the school district you're interested in. We'll take a break. And when we come back, news about electricity rates, Central Hudson and Gas Electric and their proposed 3-year rate hike. We'll find out what's happened next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Anna Malaika Tubbs. Her new book, Erased, What American Patriarchy Has Hidden From Us, investigates gendered systems of oppression and what makes their American version unique. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
I think this is a moment for a strong, steady hand.
On the next Radiolab,
former Secretary of Defense and former Director of the CIA,
of the intelligence. We talk to national security expert Leon Panetta.
If we have to go after terrorists,
has to be comprehensive.
About square dancing.
It came out of nowhere.
Back to the ride, don't take all night.
An American tradition or a whitewashed plot? That's on the next Radiolab. This afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, high electric bills are still top of mind for many folks in New York. Central Hudson Gas and Electric has proposed a 3-year settlement to its rate case with the New York Public Service Commission. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Jesse King reports.
Central Hudson was initially seeking a 1-year rate increase to start July 1st that would increase customers' total monthly electric and gas bills by 5.3% and 5.9% respectively. The new joint proposal, made with staff at the Department of Public Service and some intervening parties, would increase customers' total monthly bills by smaller amounts over the course of 3 years. For year one, that comes out to a hike of 3.1%, or $5.43 for the average monthly electric bill, and 5.1%, or $7.73 for the average monthly gas bill. Hikes in years two and three would be higher. Low-income customers, meanwhile, would actually see their rates decrease slightly for the first year. Joe Jenkins is a spokesperson for Central Hudson.
They'll see a decrease of about 4%, or between $3.85 and $4 per month decrease on their bill. So we wanted to minimize the impacts for the majority of our customers, but we wanted to make sure that we are making efforts to really protect the most vulnerable customers we have in our service area.
Customers must be part of the Base Level Home Energy Assistance Program or have other benefits to qualify for the lower rate. The settlement comes during yet another contentious rate case for Central Hudson, which drew public outcry after requesting a double-digit rate hike for 2024. The PSC ended up slashing that significantly, but many lawmakers wanted commissioners to reject it outright. That sentiment hasn't gone away, and it's not limited to Central Hudson. Con Edison and National Grid are also requesting higher rates right now, despite public opposition and concern over the rising cost of living. A recent survey found a majority of residents in four Hudson Valley counties are living paycheck to paycheck, with utility costs being among their top financial burdens. So far, Central Hudson's settlement is getting mixed reviews. State Assemblyman Jonathan Jacobson, a Democrat from the 104th District, says the PSC should reject it.
This is no bargain. Despite Central Hudson's pronouncement, this is no bargain for customers.
He's not the only one. Assemblymember Sarah Hanna Shrestha, a Democrat from the 103rd District, says she opposes the overall deal. Democratic State Senator Michelle Hinchey from the 41st District says, quote, too many people are being crushed by the cost of living, even those who don't qualify for assistance, which makes these kinds of rate increases completely unsustainable, end quote. The Public Utility Law Project, a consumer advocacy group, says it is staying neutral on the subject. Executive Director Lori Wheelock says the overall increase will still place a burden on customers, but there are positives to the settlement, including short-term payment plans with waived late fees for some customers, protections against utility shutoffs during extreme cold and heat, Spanish language bills, and increased enrollment in Central Hudson's low-income discount program.
Those who are in this monthly discount program are pretty much at even, like the bill increase will not affect them. And so we thought that was also really important, especially now with certain federal programs potentially, you know, under attack down in Washington. Anything we can do here in New York to, in particular, to help low-income customers is extremely important.
Wheelock notes, however, that this case continues what some see as a pattern of utilities requesting higher rate increases to settle with the PSC for what they really want. Jacobson notes this time around the increase laid out in the settlement is actually a lot closer to Central Hudson's initial request than the result they got last year from the PSC. Jenkins says the rate increases are needed to improve Central Hudson's infrastructure, ramp up cybersecurity efforts, and keep up with New York's clean energy goals. All things that, he says, help customers in the long run.
We believe it really takes a village to lower energy costs. We'll do everything we can on our part to keep our costs in line, but it takes collaborative relationships with all of the other parties, and we're open to those discussions and working with our lawmakers to make that happen for our customers.
The PSC isn't expected to rule on the settlement until the fall. Central Hudson's current delivery rates, which were set to expire July 1st, will continue until a ruling is made. Reporting for WAMC's Hudson Valley Bureau on the campus of Vassar College, I'm Jesse King.
And thanks to the New York Public News Network for that. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Science Stories with Joe Johnson. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180. Building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Take a dive into the deep end, the ultimate rock music journey. Deep cuts, live tracks, and rare gems from rock, psychedelia, country, jazz, and blues. Experience the deep cuts on the deep end. Friday nights at 10, only on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Joe Johnson is our resident science guy who brings us science story that caught his eye. This week, turning lead into gold. Where did that Soviet spacecraft lander land? And scientists have created a hairy mouse with woolly mammoth traits. Is that a step toward bringing back the extinct giant? Here's Joe.
The hairy mice were created with mammoth genes, and the dire wolves were recreated from gray wolves. And what they have in common is the biotech company responsible for it, a company called Colossal Biosciences. Now, the mice were announced in early March, and they were created as an experiment trying to link specific DNA sequences to certain physical traits. They made seven edits. The scientists made seven edits to genes for hair length, hair thickness, texture, color, and genes regulating body fat. And this is the first time they made multiple edits at once. Okay, this is some pretty cool stuff. This is cutting-edge stuff. The results? The mice were fatter with long, wavy hair. And if you look at the picture online, they're cute as
hell.
They
are really cute. Little puffballs.
They are. Now, they did this with two goals in mind. They wanted to see if they could make specific edits and produce healthy, fully functional animals to see if they could carry the process through from egg through a living critter, and to see if the mice would have greater cold weather adaptation. That's the fat gene edit they made. The eventual goal is to create a mammoth-like animal using Asian elephants as a starting point. They say that releasing hundreds of them into the wild could reduce climate change by stimulating growth on the tundra. And their goal for the first mammoth-like critter is going to be 2028.
Wow. Yeah. Now, there's been some criticism of this company. Some people saying it's a publicity stunt.
A lot of people are saying it's a publicity stunt.
What are they saying?
Well, they say that it has a chance of increasing biodiversity and decreasing the chance that a niche species, something that's really important, could go extinct, so that they could literally de-extinct it if it did.
It's kind of amazing, and they're kind of cute.
Yeah, they are. Now, the dire wolves, this story hit the media about a month ago when they released some pictures. The original range of the dire wolf was North and South America, and they actually went extinct about 13,000 years ago. What they did is they got some direwolf DNA from two ancient samples. They had a 13,000-year-old tooth and a 72,000-year-old inner ear bone because it's so dense, it actually protects the DNA within it. There's like hundreds of these skeletons in the La Brea tar pits in California, but the heat and the tar just destroys all the DNA. So finding, you know, relatively intact DNA was hard. They extracted the DNA, they compared it to the modern gray wolf, and they made 20 specific edits to that DNA to make it more like a dire wolf. It is not an exact copy of a dire wolf. It's not a duplicate. So far, they've produced two males, Romulus and Remus. They were born in October 2024. And a female, Khaleesi, which was born in January of 2025. And they call this de-extinction. Mm. But I kind of don't buy it.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
Well, it's not an exact copy of the dire wolf. And until you can get an entire, you know, genome of a dire wolf and duplicate that, I don't think you bring in the dire wolf back. You have a dire wolf-like gray fox.
The ultimate goal of this company, as you mentioned before, is that they want to create these mammoth elements, the woolly mammoth.
Yeah, they're going to start with an Asian elephant, which I guess is pretty close to what a mammoth was, and make specific edits to it to turn it into what they call a mammoth-like creature. They didn't call it a mammoth.
And with the mammoth and the mice we talked about and the dire wolves, is there a real ecological reason that they could benefit the Earth?
Now, a lot of people, like you were saying before, think this is a publicity stunt. But I do have to tell you that Colossal Biosciences has done a lot of really solid science researching this stuff, embryonic development, genetic manipulation. They have created brand new mammoth DNA. Brand new, not like recreated from some other organism. And the strange thing is they're creating artificial wombs. They're developing artificial wombs to develop these mammoth and so that they can release them. So they have done a lot of really solid science.
A professor of environmental philosophy at the University of Montana, Christopher Preston, said they appear to be paying attention to animal welfare issues.
They do. They have a big animal welfare team that works with these animals to make sure that they're well cared for.
And they also have some support from the American Humane Society.
Yeah. Now, next up, by the way, their new goals are their next projects are going to be the thylacine, which is a Tasmanian tiger that went extinct, and the dodo. They think they can bring both of them back.
Let's bring the dodo back. Speaking of coming back, the failed Soviet lander Cosmos 482 crashed back to Earth.
It did.
We were trying to figure out where it was going to crash. What happened?
Right. Well, first of all, let's do the backstory on it. The Cosmos 482 is a Soviet era lander launched in 1972, and its mission was going to be to go to Venus, land on Venus, do some science on Venus. I'm not sure exactly what was on board. But it never made it out of orbit. The booster malfunctioned. There was a timer delay or something I think I read about. And the booster actually burned up, came back into the Earth's atmosphere back in 1981. But the lander, which is pretty robust, stayed in orbit. Now, it was spotted over Germany last May 10th at 8:04 local time by some scientists at the Fraunhofer Institute for High Energy Physics. They have a radar dish that they were tracking it with. And then the next anticipated orbit, which should have been 9:32 local time, and it never made it. It never showed up. Other reports have it burning up in the Indian Ocean. That apparently somebody was tracking it with radar. So Cosmos 482, you had a good run, but all done.
Welcome back. All right, here's another story about turning lead into gold. Suddenly people are paying attention here.
kind of give you the backstory on this. The history of science to me is fascinating. The way that science was done, the people were involved, the events that happened. You can go back all the way to a couple of Greek philosophers, Democritus and Leucippus, fifth century Greek philosophers. They're walking along the beach one day and they say, might not everything in the universe be like the beach? Little tiny particles when you get up close enough. And they named them atmos, which means uncuttable or indivisible. And that kind of gave us our modern idea of atoms hundreds of years later. A guy named John Dalton picked it up. Lots of interesting characters in science history. Galileo, Kepler, Newton, Copernicus. These are people you know, but there's a lot of them. But the one that I want to talk about today was a kind of a proto-science called alchemy. And it was a philosophy system, proto-science. They recognized that materials could be changed by what we now call a chemical reaction. Okay. They didn't understand the mechanisms going on there. They had a lot of goals. They were looking for a panacea, some universal cure that would cure whatever disease, an elixir of immortality to help you live forever. There was actually a Chinese, emperor that, was told to drink mercury because it would make him live forever. And it didn't. And the probably the most well-known goal of theirs was changing base metals like lead into gold, what we call transmutation. Now, this is impossible given the technology they have because, you know, the differences in the number of protons. That's what makes lead and gold different. Lead has 82 protons and gold has 79 protons. And unless you can change the number of protons, it's impossible to change lead into gold. Until now, yeah. Scientists at CERN using the Large Hadron Collider have accomplished this, but it actually wasn't their goal. They were firing lead ions at each other at nearly the speed of light to try to find out what happens when very heavy particles crash together. And they were thinking about the Big Bang and what happened during that. Now, what happened with the lead ions is as they passed each other, you know, the lead ion has a very strong positive charge. And so what was happening was it was actually they were passing each other and the two positive charges repelled each other. And if a certain number of times, one of the lead ions would have three of its protons knocked out and go from 82 protons to 79 protons and actually change into a gold ion.
How much gold did they make?
Well, it was calculated between the years 2015 and 2018 when they were doing what's called the ALICE experiment. They created about 86 billion gold nuclei, which would be about 29 trillionths of a gram. That's not a lot. Now, most of these unstable, fast-moving gold atoms would have lasted for about a microsecond, which is about a millionth of a second, because they're very unstable, or they would crash into the side of the chamber. One of the authors of the article I read joked that the CERN researchers currently have no plans to take up gold-making as a side hustle, but say that a better understanding how nuclei change will help them to improve the Large Hadron Collider's performance.
So as in many cases, the research behind it is going to be important moving forward.
Absolutely. It's very, very cool, but the science is the real goal here.
Right. And you know who are another important figure in science?
Who's that?
You mentioned some of those names? Joe Johnson. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, some unique camping options at Frost Valley YMCA. We'll learn more next. This is Radio Chatskill. Hi, I'm Tim Bruno, General Manager at Radio Catskill. Hudson Valley Gives is today, and we need you. Your donation helps keep trusted news, diverse voices, and local culture on the air for everyone. Give where you live. Go to hvgives.org and donate to Radio Catskill today. We're navigating uncertainty with the strength of our community behind us. Donate at hvgives.org. Thank you.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As summer approaches and families start mapping out their warm weather plans, many are trading in the usual s'mores and sleeping bags for something a little more adventurous. At Frost Valley YMCA here in the Catskills, kids can hike, ride horses, and even grow their own food and discover who they are along the way. Here with us today is Callie Rade, Executive Director of Camping Services at Frost Valley, to chat about how these one-of-a-kind specialty camps are sparking a love of nature and adventure in the next generation of explorers, animal enthusiasts, and outdoor leaders. Callie, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, first of all, I have to say you have a really great title, Executive Director of Camping. That's a cool title.
I know, such a fun one, right?
Let's talk about your specialty overnight camps I mentioned. You do have the traditional camps, but what sets these apart from those traditional overnight camps?
Yeah, absolutely. So, we really at Frost Valley try to have something for everyone. So the traditional resident camp models are a great sort of way to experience summer camp for the first time and try a lot of activities that you wouldn't normally get to in your everyday life. But like you said, we do try to have great options. So we have an adventure program, which is a more rustic camp experience that includes mini trips throughout the Catskills and the Gunks as well, where they'll do things like canoeing and hiking and rock climbing. To our farm camp, which is operated on a fully functional farm with focused gardening and barn specialties. So campers can learn all of the skills it takes to sort of run a farm, as well as, just how to prepare their meals, how to care for animals, how to grow and prepare their food.
I want to ask you a little bit more about each one of those camps you mentioned, the adventure programs. Yeah. What kind of camper is drawn to these types of experiences?
Yeah, for the adventure program, I think anyone who has even a curiosity for the outdoors. So all of our programs are progressive. So from Adventure Ramblers, which is really that introduction to adventure, a one-week program, is a great opportunity for anyone who's interested in the outdoors, interested in a camping experience, but maybe hasn't had a ton of experience. And then those progress, like I said, into Adventure Village, which is a two-week experience and includes a three-day mini trip. Where they're out and about, like I said, in the Catskills or the Gunks, all the way through our teen adventure program. So we have teen adventure trips that go all over the East Coast, from our Maine coast trip to our West Virginia rafting trip. And then there's individual tracks for the adventure trips as well. So ones that are focused on stewardship and sort of giving back, ones that are focused on helping you to develop real leadership skills, and then the experiential track, which is just having a really high quality experience in a new place.
When I was a kid, we went to a lake and went camping with my family. I think I learned how to collect wood for the fire. What life skills do campers typically take away from more adventure-based programs, though?
Yeah, so many. So they'll learn how to build a fire. They'll learn how to cook outdoors, how to prepare meals outdoors. They'll learn how to, set up a tent. They'll learn how to pack their packs efficiently. We have a trip center that is stocked with all of the resources that you need to participate in any sort of backpacking or camping experience. So really trying to make sure that having the access to equipment is not a barrier for folks who are coming to camp. So they'll visit the trip center. They'll learn how to, exactly what they need. They'll pack their packs and really just have a really experiential hands-on experience learning all of those skills. And then I would say in our adventure programs as well, there's a really big kind of team building component as well to teaching kids how to work together to overcome challenges.
horse camps are a major draw, I can imagine, at Frost Valley. You've got some for, you know, for some, like, you know, more experienced campers going out, backcountry horse trekking. But what about for beginners? Mm-hmm. You have, I think they're called the Mustang and Durango Villages for beginners. Tell us a little bit more about those.
They are, yeah. So Mustang and Durango Village are introductory horse camp programs. So it is everything we love about traditional overnight camps. It's actually on the main property where our resident camps are. But their specialty program, their hard skill building component of their summer camp experience is equestrian and is horseback riding. So they'll visit our barn for the entire afternoon and they'll do ground lessons and they learn about, you know, how to care for their horses, how to tack their horses, how to groom their horses. They'll learn, you know, the different parts of a horse, different types of horses, and then pair that with some horseback riding lessons. And so it's great because they are really small groups. They're in lesson groups of about four campers at a time with a dedicated instructor. And one of the big draws, I think, for that program, for folks who are really interested in horses or really enjoy horses, is they actually get paired with a horse for their entire session. So that's always a really special moment, is campers finding out who their horse is going to be for the the session, and then sort of the relationship that they're able to build with that horse.
Well, I was just going to ask, how do you help build confidence for folks who might be, or folks for kids who might be, well, they're folks too, who might be experienced horses for their first time? I guess that sort of pairing part is a way to build confidence.
Absolutely. Yeah. So our equestrian and our barn team does a really great job of getting to know kids and sort of engaging with them to see what their comfort level is. And so the first couple of days of the program will be really introductory, you know, just kind of walking with the horse, grooming the horse, feeding the horse. So they're able to assess, you know, what kind of horse might be.
And then let's talk about farm camp. It's kind of a world of its own. It's a few miles from the main site at Frost Valley.
We believe in sort of this model of challenge by choice.
Oh.
So encouraging kids to take positive risk and healthy risk, because that's a great way for us to learn and grow. But, you know, at the same time, not pushing a kid too far to do something that they're not feeling quite ready for.
You dropped out a little bit there, and I thought we were moving on to the next question, but you were finishing up and talking about how building confidence there. So just for the listener, that we had a little drop in your answer there, but I think we got you solid here. My question, though, was to move on about to farm camp. Yeah, can you hear me?
Sorry, Tim. I think I lost you for a second there.
Yeah, we were having a little bit of a connection problem there, but are you hearing me okay now?
Yes.
Okay, let's talk about farm camp, a world of its own. It's about 12 miles from the main Frost Valley site. What's the experience like for kids who choose this program?
Yeah, so the farm camp, I think, is unique from some of the other programs because it is one of our smaller camps. So I would say has a little bit of a slower pace, a more intimate sort of setting, which I think certain kids will really thrive in that kind of environment. But yeah, open to grades 2 through 10. It's a 515-acre working farm. We have a barn full of different animals, you know, a colorful garden with, you know, native pollinators and flowers, all sorts of native plants. And I think one of the fun parts about farm camp is every weekend there is a harvest day. So the kids will actually harvest and then they'll prepare this big sort of celebratory dinner from all of the produce that we collected that day.
That's got to be impactful for them, like, you know, going from seed to the actual vegetable or organic item that they've produced. What kind of feedback do you get from campers and parents about this farm camp experience?
Yeah, kids really love it. I think the farm camp really fosters this connection to the environment. I think it's so important for kids and all people to really understand where their food comes from. And so I think through the program curriculum, but then also, you know, I think there's a pretty great arts and crafts kind of program within the farm space as well. So, you know, taking the wool from the sheep, how do we clean it? How do we dye it? How can we create sustainable goods from there? So there really is this sort of lens of sustainability, within the programming at the farm.
And how do you guide families to decide which camp is the best fit for their child?
Yeah, I think we try to make it easy for folks to have information. So we have, you know, virtual info sessions that are pre-recorded and on the website, but also have live ones every couple of weeks, open houses so folks can come and actually see the property and meet some of the team. But of course, we connect with folks via email and phone all of the time. And so I think for us, it's really just sort of asking questions, like, what do you want this summer camp experience to be like for your kids? What do your kids want to get out of this experience? What are they interested in? Have they been to camp before? Have they not been to camp before? And just by asking some of those questions, we can generally do a pretty good job of pointing them in the right direction.
And where can families go to learn more, ask those questions, or register for some of these amazing camps?
Yeah, so you can see all about our camps online, so frostvalley.org. Or if they want to connect directly with me or one of our camp directors, they can shoot us an email, campdirector@frostvalley.org.
Yeah, well, before we go, I want to ask you, and I don't want this to be like, you know, picking your favorite child, but do you happen to have a favorite experience or maybe a memorable experience from one of your camps?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, it's so hard. But yeah, for me, I think it's some of the small wins. I think it's seeing a child who comes to camp for the first time and is really, really struggling to, you know, kind of find their place and you know, just kind of seeing that transformation. I mean, we see it all the time over the course of summer, kids building confidence, kids taking risks, like a kid who was terrified of the high ropes course on the first day of camp. By the end of it, they're going down the zip line and they're just so proud of themselves for having accomplished something. So I think it's that. I think it's the small moments of growth that we get to see kind of every day.
Very cool. Callie Redday is Executive Director of Camping Services at Frost Valley YMCA. Callie, thanks so much for joining us today. Have a great summer.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, we'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk to Debbie Gillette, our friend from the Chamber of Commerce at the Northern Poconos, about what's going on this summer over there. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill's Music Yard Sale is this Saturday, going from 10 to 3 at Radio Catskill Studios. We have everything musical, vinyl records, LPs, 45s, used audio equipment, stereos, receivers, turntables, cassette decks, record players, reel-to-reels, also CDs, cassettes, 8-tracks, so much more, all priced to move and cash or Venmo accepted. The Radio Catskill Music Yard Sale, one day only, this Saturday, 10 to 3 at Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. A young Latina mom's journey of healing from gun violence and postpartum depression in a country where there's little support for either.
I feel like she really saved me in so many different ways that I would have never thought.
And how a faja can save your life. That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, joining us now, Debbie Gillette, Executive Director of the Chamber of Commerce of the Northern Poconos. She's here to give us an inside look of how the Chamber is helping build a stronger, more connected community and highlight some upcoming events. Debbie, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, really good. And just wanted to remind folks that we partnered with you guys for our Chamber Chat series earlier this week. We had Brian Fulp from the Himalayan Institute to talk about what's going on over there. And it's always been it's a great partnership. I want to just remind people about what you guys do there. What role does the Chamber play in the community?
Well, we are the Chamber of Commerce that represents both Wayne and Pike counties in the Northern Pocono Mountains. Many people are a little bit confused of what a Chamber of Commerce is. We are a nonprofit organization, and we support local and regional businesses and professionals to help promote them, give referrals, and help to support our local economy here. So, and we do, like you said, host many events throughout the year, both community events and business events, not just to bring visitors and tourism into the Wayne and Pike County area, but also to help the businesses that are here prosper and grow. So we do have leadership development programs for just high school juniors from 4 school districts, but also an adult program as well. We do a lot of referrals for our local businesses. People still pick up the phone and call, believe it or not, a Chamber of Commerce to see what businesses are in the region for whatever goods and services they need. And we only refer to our local Chamber member businesses.
Yeah.
For those things. We do a lot of educational training seminars, networking events for other businesses to learn about each other and how they can work together in different projects and things, and how they can support each other. We started a new Women in Business WIN program this year to help grow women-owned businesses and help support each other. And we have luncheons once a quarter on various topics. We just had one on women's health care a couple of weeks ago, and we're looking forward to the one in August, which will be in downtown Milford, and we'll be speaking to the women about how they can network and grow with other businesses to help grow not just themselves personally, but their business growth as well. We partner with a lot of other organizations to help businesses find funding, low interest loans, how to expand their business by writing business plans. So we hook them up with the SBDC, the SBA, NEPA Alliance for Funding, lots of other organizations. So we're always moving and doing things here, just to help make the connections for businesses, but also connecting community members to the businesses that are here in the region.
And, you know, on the website, you help promote a lot of events in the area. A couple of big ones coming up soon, the Pocono Dragon Boat Race and then the Wally Lake Fest. Anything else that you want to highlight that's coming up that's especially exciting, both for business owners and the public?
We also, those are chamber events, believe it or not, that we actually organize and run for the community. And we also do the fireworks over Lake Wallenpaupack on the 4th of July. We've been doing them since 1975. Yeah. So we are always looking for businesses who would like to sponsor those events and participate that way. Because those events do draw a lot of people from out of the area here. So by sponsoring, we help get the word out about the businesses that are here in the community. Because, of course, we want, when they're visiting, those to support all of our local businesses here.
Yeah, it's a huge display in the whole region. Yeah. You know, it's the Catskills here on the New York side. In the middle, you got the Upper Delaware River Corridor, Northern Poconos, no matter what you call it. What do you think the region, what makes it so special?
It's our quality of life that we have. Of course, the scenery that God has given us is absolutely beautiful, but it's also the quality of life and the things that we have here, the values that the local residents and the businesses hold. And hospitality is our main industry, and tourism, very true with what's up in the Catskill Mountains as well. And if we weren't friendly and welcoming to the people that visit us, they wouldn't come back. And we're a little unique that we have some beautiful Main Street downtowns that are walkable downtowns that you can go and visit on, whether it's in Hawley, in Honesdale, in Milford, that are walkable downtowns. But we have some drivable downtowns with great businesses, too. Yeah. Whether you're up in the north in the Upper Delaware region and where things are a little bit more spread out. But we are also host to many, there's over 70 summer overnight camps in Wayne and Pike counties that, you know, people from other areas send their kids here for the summer for activities and learning and the great things that we have to offer. So that's spread all up through the Upper Delaware region. It's spread all through the Northern Pocono Mountains. So, you know, our population more than quadruples in the summer because of those summer camps, but people wouldn't be coming back generation after generation and sending their kids here if this wasn't a beautiful place and if our people weren't welcoming to them.
Debbie Gillette is the executive director of the Chamber of the Northern Poconos. There's more information at their website, northernpoconos.org. Debbie, thank you so much. I hope you have a terrific summer, and I'll let you go so you can plan those huge events that are coming up that we mentioned.
Yes, we are in the midst of all of them, and we welcome you all to come and join us and enjoy the Northern Pocono Mountains.
Debbie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder today is Hudson Valley Gives. You can help support the station at hvgives.org. Any amount helps us navigate the uncertainty we're currently facing with your support behind us. Again, that's hvgives.org. You can donate at any time up until midnight to support public radio in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union, and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
On the TED Radio Hour, Harvard Business School professor Amy Edmondson says giving negative feedback to employees is the kind thing for bosses to do, even if it doesn't seem nice.
Nice is the easy way out. Makes me comfortable in the moment, but it doesn't take care of you and it doesn't take care of the future.
Ideas about making teams work. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Chatskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Forecast today, it's going to be breezy, chilly, and rainy.